You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Good morning. It is time for another edition of The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I am your host for this week, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. On the Doctor's Lounge, you get to hear what doctors have to say, what's important to us. You get to learn about who doctors are, what makes us think, what makes us tick, what makes us excited, what makes us angry, what makes us afraid. This is the show to come to, just like a doctor's lounge in a hospital. You hear doctors talking. It's Thursday morning. The coffee's hot, breakfast is served, and the doctors are talking. So thank you very much for joining us today. This time of year, the sort of end of February, beginning of March, is kind of my worst time of year. I may have opened the show with this last time. I don't even remember. But, you know, the holidays are long behind us, and the weather is really crappy here in Atlanta. I guess I shouldn't complain, because it could be Boston or it could be Kentucky, and all this rain could be snow, and that would certainly be worse. And like I talked about last week, I'm grateful that this weather, although it's kind of yucky, doesn't really hurt our ability to keep our doors open and keep seeing patients. But one of the things that I kind of look forward to this time of year is that it's usually a bit slow, and it gives us a little bit of time to sort of, you know, refurbish things and clear your head and kind of get ready for when spring allergy season comes along. The other nice thing about this time of year is it's my wife Amy's birthday is this time of year, and that's always a nice thing. This year at work has been different, though. It has been much heavier than usual. February was my busiest February in 20 years. And you should say, well, that's good. You should be grateful, right? That's good for the numbers, and it's good to be busy. And that's true, although I miss the rest. And as I get into my, you know, low 50s, mid-50s, the physical stress of surgery begins to take its toll. I spend about 35 to 40% of my time in the operating room doing either endoscopic procedures or open procedures through an incision. I'm probably one of the few ear, nose, and throat doctors that still does a lot of stuff through an incision. It's taking its physical toll. And why am I belly aching about this? Again, the reason I am doing this is because one of the goals that I have for the times when it's my turn to be at this microphone is to make you, the listener, for whom we are very grateful, make you familiar or to refamiliarize you with who doctors are. And the kind of things that we live with. Because as I have said the last couple of shows and will continue to say as much as I can and as much as you're willing to listen to it, is that there are other folks in the healthcare system. We will politely refer to them as competitive stakeholders, as I have in the past. Folks like administrators, insurers, probably most prominently politicians, who want you to believe that we are different than we really are. They don't want you to know who doctors really are. And so part of what my self-imposed mission is to educate you as to who doctors really are. The other folks, the competitive stakeholders, they want you to believe that we breeze into our jobs at 9:30 and we work for a couple of hours and then we take a two-hour lunch and then we go and play golf at 1 o'clock. President Obama wants you to believe, as he has actually said in the past, that we get rich taking tonsils out of people. So rich, in fact, that we do it on everyone we can get our hands on. That's obviously not true. He would even have you believe that doctors get paid $30,000 to amputate a leg. You know, everything we do in our office is all laid out for us. We have armies of assistants, and that being a doctor is the easy life. I'm here to tell you that's not true. And there's lots of ways it's not the easy life, but the one I'm going to talk about this morning is the physical toll that the practice of medicine takes on physicians. Now, I have promised that we will talk about pay for performance this morning, and we will. But as usual, in my introductory segment, I like to talk a little bit about something else and sort of touch on this issue of who doctors really are and what we're really like and the lives that we really live, as opposed to the propaganda you are exposed to that would suggest something very different than what's actually true. The practice of medicine is physical. The act of surgery is physical. Now, there are doctors out there who can wear white coats and ties to work and have a time that perhaps isn't that physical, although they probably shouldn't be wearing white jackets and ties anymore because it has been recognized and recommended by the American Hospital Association that white coats and ties are vectors that spread disease. right? You go into a hospital room or even a patient in your office, and if that patient has an infection and you touch them with your tie or your white coat, you now pick that up and you go, and the next patient, the tie touches the next patient, and you have you've become a vector for the spread of an infectious disease. So that shouldn't be happening anyway, but the bottom line is, you know, in my work as an ear, nose, and throat doctor, my job is very physical. It's very physical in the operating room. The end of a surgical day leaves, you know, just about every part of me sore, and it takes a couple of days to recover. In the office, it's not quite as bad, but similar. You know, we have to kind of turn upside down to look in somebody's ear, especially if it's a squirming child. You know, doing a head and neck exam and a laryngoscopy and the office procedures that we do are a physical thing. And if you're watching on the webcam, that's why you can see that, you know, my uniform for work is not ever, except on very rare occasions, going to involve a jacket and a tie, because I just can't move around the way I need to. So I've got my wintertime uniform on here of a pullover shirt, which also conveniently hides the gut, but that's a story for another day. But in any case, there are some data. There are some data that support what I'm telling you. There is one Dr. Adrian Park at the University of Maryland who published a study in 2010 and found that occupational injuries in surgeons are common, as I am telling you. The interesting thing about this particular study is that it looked at surgeons performing laparoscopic surgery. Right. This has been a new thing. This began about the time that I was in residency at Vanderbilt when laparoscopic cholecystectomies came out. And this was a very big deal. This was a very significant advancement in the treatment of, you know, an inflamed gallbladder or gallstones. The old way to do that operation was to make a huge incision across the abdomen, remove the gallbladder off the bottom side of the liver through an open procedure with a big incision. And that worked well as far as treating the disease goes, but left this patient with a huge incision and a 6-week in-bed recovery. And during my training in my 2 years in general surgery, and I think I was probably the last ear, nose, and throat physician on the planet whose training included 2 full years of general surgery, is just when the switch began. We were one of the first places to start doing the removal of the gallbladder through a small scope instead of a huge incision. And that's a great thing. No question about it. It took the recovery from 6 weeks down to a couple of days, reduced the rate of complications, a win-win all around. Reduced costs, I believe. Very nice thing. But what hasn't been realized until this study came out is that although the patient's recovery from the operation is a lot shorter, the surgeon's recovery from the operation, if you will, becomes a lot longer, because in order to do things through an endoscope on a video screen, we surgeons have to contort ourselves into all sorts of unnatural positions to see the monitor or adjust the scope or adjust 2 or 3 instruments, right? In the laparoscopic surgery, without getting too technical, has got at least a couple of instruments through a couple of small incisions. And so you've got to have folks sort of driving all these things at the same time so that the instruments are doing what they're supposed to be doing and the camera is looking at what it's supposed to be looking at. And so you've got at least 3 ports that you're working through. And, you know, and I know from my experience with endoscopic sinus surgery, which isn't quite that complex but gets close, is that you have to contort your back and your head and your neck and shoulders and arms and hands into all sorts of crazy positions in order to get the job done. So in a sense, the surgeon has sacrificed his or her body, his or herself, bones, joints, muscles, in order for the patient's bones, joints, and muscles to have a quicker recovery and less damage and less morbidity. So this study by Dr. Park from the University of Maryland showed that 87% of surgeons who performed laparoscopic surgery, such as a laparoscopic gallbladder like we're talking about, but could be other things. Lots of things are done through a laparoscope now in the abdomen, you know, appendectomies and hernia repairs, and it's a great thing. But 87% of surgeons had some sort of physical symptoms as a result of the surgery. The age distribution was interesting. It was either very young surgeons or surgeons over 60. I would have said 10 years ago, I would have said very old surgeons instead of surgeons over 60, except 60 is getting younger and younger with every passing year. Neck, hand, and leg symptoms were the most common, and these were the most common in surgeons that performed over 150 to 200 cases per year. Well, that's just about everybody who's busy. If you're a surgeon and you're not performing 150 to 200 cases per year, either you're not working full-time or there's something up. If the operations were complex cases, such as the thyroidectomies I do, only 100 cases per year were required to put you into a high-risk category. So I do thyroidectomies. That's a high-risk surgery. I do about 150 of those per year, and 350 total cases per year is about what I do. That's thyroids plus everything else. The thyroids are about 150 cases. So that definitely puts me in the high-risk category. And again, trying to give you a taste of how we live and what we put up with. You know, as I get into my mid-50s, like most surgeons, you know, my insides are starting to show the strain. Here's another study published by my residency alma mater, Vanderbilt University, in 2013. A survey of 260 surgeons showed that at 40% of surgeons, almost half of all surgeons, sustain at least one injury in the operating room. Now, most of those go unreported. That's easy for me to believe. I mean, you know, the surgeon, we are surgeons as a group. We are going to keep going no matter what. We are not prone to call in sick or cancel cases or do something because we're not feeling well. That is just not our nature. You know, we are devoted to the patients at the expense of ourselves, and that's just the way it is. Only 22% of injured surgeons miss work because of the injury. So if you do the math, then 8% of all surgeons, injured or not, have missed work at some point due to an injury in the operating room. And that's all the more significant when you realize, as I just told you a minute ago, that the bar for us to miss work is pretty high. We're not going to call in and blow off a day's work in the operating room just because something is a little sore or something like that. It's got to be pretty bad. I think I've called in maybe twice in 20 years, just to give you an idea. So that's where we stand with surgeons and injury. There's another fact about doctors in private practice that sort of goes along with this that I want you to know. We've got, what, about 2 minutes, David, something like that. So we'll touch on this briefly, and that is that most physicians, at least in private practice. Now, I can't speak for employed physicians. I don't have any experience with that. I've never been an employed physician, so I'm not going to pretend to know how they live. But at least in private practice, most of us have a second job of sorts. Now, I'm not talking about moonlighting at a local emergency room 50 miles out of town. I'm certainly not talking about flipping burgers at McDonald's, but I'm talking about the second job that we all have to do in order for our practice to survive financially, operationally, from a regulatory standpoint, and that is of impromptu administrator, impromptu chief operating officer. Now, that's not to downplay the role of our formerly paid administrators, because God knows we owe a whole lot to them, and a good administrator is worth his or her weight in gold. So I'm not suggesting that they're not doing their job. I am suggesting that it takes both of us. It takes the formerly paid folks and the physicians about every ounce of strength and energy that we have to spare to keep a practice running, because we have to worry about the money, we have to worry about operations, we have to worry about the quality of patient care, we have to worry that everything that we're doing is legal, we have to worry that we can have enough money to make payroll, to pay the rent, to pay the malpractice premium, and that's my world, that's my time. And beyond that, you know, I do the health information technology stuff. That means, you know, between the hours of 10 p.m. and 1 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the morning, I am working on software for the EMR as well. And again, I'm not telling you this as a woe is me, poor me kind of thing. I'm saying that this is the way doctors are living. And for people who would suggest that we breeze in at 9:30, work a couple of hours, and go play golf, that just ain't so. We're at the end of the first segment. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Stay with us. That's an order.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship.
I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak, co-host of The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Please join us in the fight to save the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper and go to this website, www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We are back. Thanks for staying with us. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio, the show where you get to listen to the conversations doctors have amongst themselves in doctors' lounges and hospitals all across America. I'm your host for today, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you so much for joining us today. After a sort of an introductory segment for the first 15 minutes, as promised, as advertised, we are going to move on to the topic for the day, which is this concept called pay for performance. Now, if you don't understand exactly what that term means, we're going to go over it, so don't be thinking you're going to get bored here, because we're going to keep this fresh and talk about exactly what pay for performance is. First, we're going to talk a little bit about what has precipitated me to talk about this today rather than last week or next week or 6 months from now. This was sort of triggered by the recent announcement, hailed as a historic announcement. A lot of melodrama there. A historic announcement, according to the press release, January 26, 2015, a little over a month ago. This press release from HHS.gov starts out as better, smarter, healthier. In a historic announcement, HHS sets clear goals and timeline for shifting Medicare's reimbursements from volume to value. So let's look at what that means. In a meeting with nearly two dozen leaders, including consumers, insurers, providers, business leaders, Health and Human Services Secretary Sylvia Burwell announced that there will be measurable goals and a timeline to move Medicare payments, to move the Medicare program along an accelerated timeline that will pay providers, right, that's physicians and those who work with them, based on the quality rather than the quantity of care that they give their patients. So we're moving from volume, which is something that is pretty easy to measure, and how many patients do you see and what are you doing? We're sort of comfortable with that, to something which is very ethereal, right? Value, right? How do you define value? Well, apparently they think they've got this figured out, or they're going to figure it out. But the announcement moves on. Today's announcement, and again, I'm reading from the press release here. Today's announcement is about improving the quality of care we receive when we're sick, while at the same time spending our healthcare dollars more wisely, said Secretary Burwell. We believe these goals can drive transformative change. I love these grandiose terms that they come up with. Historic announcements, transformative change, manage and track progress, and create accountability. So, you know, if you believe this at face value, my gosh, this is huge if you believe it at face value. Well, some people believe it at face value because we've got several prominent people as a part of this press release that are buying in. We have Douglas Henley, Executive Vice President of the American Academy of Family Physicians, saying, we are in. I think that's the goal. We're on board. I'm sorry. The quote is, we are on board, says the president of the American Academy of Family Physicians. We're committed to changing how we pay for and deliver care. America's Health Insurance Plans. That's a group, America's Health Insurance Plans. President and CEO Karen Ignani says health plans have been on the forefront of implementing payment reforms. We need a fundamental transformation. So all of these things, all of this propaganda stuff. Here's another one. There is considerable bipartisan support for moving away from fee-for-service toward alternative payment values that reward value, improve outcomes, reduce costs, all these wonderful things. And it goes on. There's other folks here, president of the National Partnership for Women and Families. And finally, at the bottom, something catches my eye here that says, In addition, the health information technology, through widespread use of health information technology, the healthcare data needed to track these efforts is now available. Really? I haven't heard that, and I try to keep up with this stuff as much as I can. I don't know of any specific examples where data obtained from a health information technology system has allowed the efforts to track value, I mean true value, not arbitrary measurements, but true value has ever been figured out. Today's announcement would continue, again, I'm back to reading the press release, would continue the shift towards paying providers for what works. Whether it's something as complex as preventing or treating disease or something as straightforward as being sure a patient has time to ask questions. Again, at face value, who can argue? At face value, this all sounds great. Of course, we want more value, whatever that means. You know, of course, we want to move away from a fee-for-service system that has does incentivize physicians to do more stuff, whether that stuff is beneficial or not. And we all know docs in our own little markets that leverage that perhaps farther than they should. So yes, no question about it. That something, you know, needs to happen or should happen at some level with a system that only rewards quantity over quality. What you may not realize is that this has been tried before. Efforts to get away from a fee-for-service system that does nothing but reward the amount of work that you do. There was a big one tried 25 or 30 years ago and was finally discontinued because it didn't work so well. That's called capitation. Now, if you're a physician, you're probably familiar with capitation. If you're not a physician, there's a good chance that you're not familiar with capitation. So we will walk through it briefly. Capitation is very important in my past because when I was hired into Atlanta, the main purpose for which I was hired in 1995 was to service a capitation contract that the practice who hired me had just acquired. I was going to be the doc for the capitation contract that had just been acquired. So what is capitation? Well, you know, derived from the word Latin word capita, right, which means head, like per capita, per person. Instead of getting paid per visit, where you see a patient for a sick problem, you submit a fee, and then the insurance company pays a fraction of that fee, you are instead paid for the number of covered lives that you have. Now, what is a covered life? That means an insurer comes to you and says, we have 100,000 people. Right, that's a low number, but we take a round number. 100,000 people. Any of those 100,000 people that have an ENT problem, you are going to see them without billing anything in additional. You will get the money from what's called a capitation check. So let's say that you get 50 cents per person per month. Okay, so 50 cents per person per month would be $50,000 if you're covering 100,000 people. I follow that math. 50 cents per person per month times 100,000 covered lives is $50,000. Now, for that, you think, oh, wow, that's a lot of money. Well, except that you've got to cover all of the ENT visits and all of the surgery, right? Anything that those people need, whether it's a prescription or an operation, you're going to provide it for no additional money. So if a patient comes in and they're perfectly well and you give them a checkup or give them a prescription for allergies, well, that's good. Right, you got money and you didn't have to work very hard. If a patient comes in with cancer and you have to perform a 6-hour operation to get that cancer out of them and then do, you know, weeks and weeks of post-op care, how much extra do you get paid for all that extra work? Zero. Nil. Nothing. So it depends critically on the patient population that you are covering. If it's a well population, you can do well. If it's a sick population, you're going to get creamed. And that's part of the problem, is trying to figure out what the future brings when you accept a contract like that. Finally, those things kind of went by the wayside, because just as fee-for-service provides an incentive to provide as much care as possible, capitation provided an incentive to provide as little care as possible. So we run into the same problem no matter how you slice it. When you have the patient out of the equation, when you have a third party paying most or all of the expense of healthcare, and the patient's out of the loop, and to a large degree the doctor is out of the loop, you have no direct method of measuring quality. You have no direct method of measuring value. The third party payer has to guess after the fact, based on arbitrary measurements that they can pull from claims data, from medical records, and try to guess after the care event is long gone and long finished, to figure out how much quality was there and try to reimburse accordingly. So we have a situation where fee-for-service has its issues, capitation has its issues, and next comes the next great thing, which is this pay-for-performance thing, hailed as the way that we're going to, you know, fix the incentive system for providers. So what does the term pay-for-performance mean? Well, it actually came from outside of healthcare. It's been used on teachers, and it's been used on chief executive officers of huge corporations to try and make them do as good a job as possible, to reward them for certain behaviors. So if you're a CEO of either a small company or even a big company, you're going to be rewarded in theory for a stock price that goes up, for earnings that goes up, for, you know, increased sales of your product, or, you know, some sort of relatively easy to measure metric thing, and base executive pay, base chief executive pay on those things. The problem is that this, you know, is the same thing that we get, whether we're talking about Obamacare or ICD-10 or meaningful use in electronic medical records. We're facing the same problem every single time with these things, which is, number one, you know, a third-party payer system that gets in the way, that keeps the patient out of the loop, that keeps the doctor out of the loop, and has this absentee payer trying to figure out what's good and what's not. And as we'll discuss the rest of the hour, you know, the fancier the plumbing, the easier it is to stop up the drain. And the more sophisticated you try to make your capitation agreement or your pay-for-performance protocol or whatever it is that you're talking about, the more prone they are to failure. The harder you try, the worse it gets. And we're going to circle around to the final position at the end of the hour that says, look, unless you get the patient back in the loop, none of this is ever going to work. We are at the end of the second segment. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Stay with us.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs.com. 4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org, and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We are back. Thanks for sticking around. You are still listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I am your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. I alternate weeks with the other co-host, the inimitable Dr. Hal Schertz, a urologist here in Atlanta. Thank you very much for spending time with us today. We are delighted that you are here. We're going to keep this thing hot and keep it moving and move on deeper into the subject of pay for performance. So as a little bit of an aside, there was some stuff I wanted to finish up from 2 weeks ago when we talked about ICD-10, which is the new coding system that we apparently will soon be forced to use as of October 1st to describe the diagnoses that we give patients. And the reason I want to do this is because when supporters of big government, right, whether they're talking about ICD-10, Obamacare, meaningful use for electronic medical records, they have this way of directing the conversation, of controlling the narrative, that really ends up beating us hands down. And we need to look at how they are doing this in order to combat this. But what they will do is control the narrative so that there are only two options to the discussion. It's either their way or some other way, which is so obviously bad that if you try to disagree with whatever they're trying to push on us, whether it's Obamacare or something else, you end up getting put on the defensive, and it becomes very difficult to get out of that. So let's use an example. I'm going to use an outrageous example because it illustrates the point. Let's say that your parents, and you know, God forbid this ever happens, but it does happen, is your child gets sick. Your child gets very sick. They've got headaches, fever, nausea, vomiting. They're obviously very sick. It's the middle of the night, but you know, as a good parent, you need to take them to the emergency room because something bad's happening, and it's happening pretty quick. So you get in the car, you drive to the emergency room. The doctors see your sick child and say, "We have a problem here. Your child's very sick. Your child's broken, needs fixing. Let's say your child has meningitis." And we need to admit this child. We need to, you know, treat them as quickly and as aggressively as possible. And the parents say, yes, 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 you know, doctor, you know, do what you need to do. The doctor says, okay, we are going to remove your child's appendix. We're going to remove your child's appendix to treat their meningitis. And the parents look at each other and go, well, gosh, we're not doctors, but that doesn't really make any sense to us. How does removing my child's appendix treat his meningitis? They don't have anything to do with each other. The doctor says, don't question. You know, we're the doctors and we know what's best. So we're going to prep your child for surgery to remove their appendix to treat their meningitis. And you get a little bit concerned. Parents get a little bit concerned, get on their smartphones, start Googling things, trying to figure out what's the connection between removing a child's appendix and meningitis, and find there is, in fact, no connection. And the parents go back to the doctor and say, hey, look, we're not comfortable with this. You know, we don't like the fix that you're offering. We don't like the treatment that you're offering. We both agree our child's ill and needs treatment, needs fixing. But, you know, we're not sure that an appendectomy is the way to go. And the doctor says, aha, negligent parents. Right, you are refusing medical therapy for your ill child. We're going to call Child Protective Services right now. We're going to have these people come to the emergency room. We're going to have them fill out a bunch of forms, take custody of your child from you so that we can take the child to the operating room ourselves and remove the child's appendix to somehow treat their meningitis. And so imagine the quandary that the parents are in. No, they're not negligent parents. They brought their child to the emergency room. Everybody agrees that the child is sick. What they disagree on is how to fix the sick child. And the doctor in this scenario, that obviously is outrageous and made up, but has taken any ability of the parents to have a meaningful conversation about the problem and has labeled the parents as negligent. Now the parents are on the defensive, and any sort of intelligent conversation about what to do with that sick child is completely destroyed by, in this case, the doctor's suppression of the third alternative. The same thing happened when we were debating Obamacare years ago. Right? We tried to say, doctors tried to say, look, we agree the healthcare system needs fixing, But Obamacare is not the way to do it. And they simply, you know, killed that ability to bring up that third alternative and simply said we were defending the status quo. We were defending our turf. We don't care about uninsured people. We don't care about people who are sick and can't afford their insurance. Of course, nothing could be further from the truth. But they've become very good at controlling the narrative such that bringing up that third alternative, right, not doing nothing to fix a problem, not refusing to fix a problem, but also not agreeing with what the big government people want to do to fix it. They suppress the ability to talk about that third alternative. And somehow, and I may be smart enough sort of to kind of outline the problem. I don't think I'm smart enough to suggest how it is that we combat that. But that's the problem that we need to combat. And now I'm going to, you know, circle back to the last soundbite from the ICD-10 hearings that I wanted to bring up and finish off with last time I was here and couldn't. These are the hearings to talk about ICD-10, and the question that you're going to hear is going to go to one of the physicians who is testifying who thought ICD-10 was a great, wonderful, fantastic thing that was going to fix all of our problems, except that Congressman Joe Pitts cornered this doc a little bit and asked a very important question, The question was, how is a new coding system for diagnoses, right? Once I diagnose a patient with sinusitis or allergies or thyroid cancer, how is the code I use to describe that, the number that I am forced to assign to that patient because of their diagnosis, how does that actually help a patient get better? And listen to this answer because you're not going
to
believe it.
Systems operations for insurers and hospitals, but how does this matter to patients?
I think, you know, for instance, if you use an ICD-9 code and a patient calls a couple days later, like if they come in with leg pain, you know which leg it is, you'll have to ask them again what or their pain was. But if you use the ICD-10 code, you can actually localize the pain to the either extremity, so it's a lot better communication tool.
Yeah, we heard a little bit.
So that's great. So the best answer that can be given, right, in congressional testimony for why a more complicated, more difficult to use coding system is going to help is that I can look at the code and see what's wrong with the patient rather than look at my own handwritten notes or, worse yet, my God, talk to the patient again. You know, that means that if I have a patient that calls me back after surgery, maybe they're worried about their incision or maybe they're worried that their neck is swollen, heaven forbid I should talk to them and say, well, okay, so we did a thyroid on you. Yeah, I remember you. It was only a couple days ago. Okay, you know, talk to me about what's wrong. No, I'm not supposed to do that. ICD-10 is going to allow me to avoid talking to the patient. I can just go to my ICD-10 code and say, oh, well, this patient was a H10.352, and somehow that's supposed to help me. I don't quite understand it. That's crazy. So then we'll go to the last soundbite because this is going to bring us back around to pay for performance. This is Dr. Terry. He was the lone hero in these proceedings, and he's going to talk about how ICD-10 codes, this new coding system, somehow circles back to pay for performance. Here we go.
I guess Dr. Terry, last question for me anyway would be, you know, the system's changing. It used to be, well, as a veterinarian, I just provided a service and I knew I was doing a good job. My patients got better. My clients were satisfied at the end of the day. But medicine in general, it seems to be moving to a more value-based outcome system. It's very different than my fee-for-service system. And frankly, we're asking the government, the taxpayer, to fund a lot of this stuff. So what's your thinking on, you know, the evolution of medicine here? I mean, you and I are a little older than some of the young bucks coming up these days, and, you know, they're going to the computer to figure out what the diagnosis is and stuff as much as relying on their own instincts. How does the movement to value-based medicine affect our view of this coding system?
Well, you're right. I am a dinosaur, but I know how to turn on a computer.
I have
to. You just opened up a whole other can of worms. What I think about value-based payment, we don't even know how to define value. Okay, so how can you pay for value when we can't even define it? You know how as a patient if my treatment is valuable, but how is the government going to define it? I'm not going to go there, but that's the problem with it. You know, they talk about all these statistics. But, you know, in medicine, we have something called the scientific method.
Okay, so, you know, I could end the show right here if I wanted to. I got 20 more minutes to fill, but I could end it right here because I think Dr. Terry said it better than I can say it. There was a couple of key things he said. He said, with this value system, you open up a whole can of worms because we don't know how to define value in healthcare. And if you try to define value in healthcare, you end up with arbitrary measurements that don't do anything, that are irrelevant. The other key thing he said is that patients know, and that's the key right there, that's going to be where I'm going to try to circle back in the next 20 minutes, is that patients know when value is delivered and when it's not. When you see your doctor, you know whether the experience that you had was a good one or wasn't a good one, and you know that if it was your own money you were spending, if it was your own money and not just paying a small copay and having insurance pay the rest, you would make a decision about whether or not you're going to ever spend your money there again. Right? It'd be like any other part of the economy. If you go somewhere and get good service, you're going to go back the next time that you need service. If you don't get good service, you're going to go somewhere else. And it just happened when I bought tires for my car. It was the same thing. Went to one place, got good service for the tires. Next time we needed tires, I was back in the same place. Why? Basics. They just took care of me. I witnessed it myself. They didn't have to report anything to some other agency to see if quality was delivered when they put new tires on my car. I could see it for myself. So why can't we use those principles for healthcare? So let's go back. I promised you in the last segment that before we talked a whole lot about pay for performance, I was going to define pay for performance. And I think the best way to do that is with an example. My father, Charles Karuchak, passed away in 1995, but in his day, he was a salesman. He sold broadcast equipment for an old company called RCA, which is kind of around in name, but isn't really much around anymore. General Electric bought them many, many moons ago. But RCA sold broadcast equipment. They sold television cameras to TV stations, radio stations, so all of that gear that you see people running around on their shoulders to gather news, my dad sold that stuff. And as a salesman, pay for performance was pretty easy because there was really only one metric. If you're a salesman, there's really only one metric, which is how much do you sell? And that's easy. It makes sense, right? He had a quota every quarter and, you know, he got his base pay no matter what, obviously. But once he made his quota, he got a bonus that was a percentage of what he made over the quota. And it worked very well. Every quarter he was pumped up to sell his quota worth of broadcast equipment, transmitters and cameras and all the stuff. That stuff didn't even, you know, in the digital age, it all got replaced. But it was pretty heavy duty equipment back then. And, you know, if he made his quota, we got extra money. If he didn't make his quota, we didn't get any extra money. And it worked very well because the metrics were easy. They were easy to understand. And there was no third party involved. You had RCA, the company selling the stuff. You had the customers, the people who were buying the stuff. And this was all measured directly by the two parties that were a part of the transaction. And we didn't have to worry about arbitrary value measurements. It was easy. If my father's customers thought they were getting value, they'd come back. If they didn't think they were getting value, they'd go to RCA's competitor, which was Ampex at the time, or in later years, Sony and Panasonic and the other Japanese companies. If they weren't getting value from what my father was giving them, they just went somewhere else. Dad's numbers went down. Value was easy to estimate in a situation like that. So that's the definition of pay for performance, is coming up with ways to measure how well you are doing your job and reward you based on how well you're doing your job. And certain jobs, like my father's sales job, lend themselves very easily to that, and that always worked. There was no belly aching about whether or not it was fair, how it was measured. It was measured. Everything worked out well. My father benefited. His company benefited. His customers benefited. It was a win-win-win for all the folks involved. So, gosh, if pay for performance works well for salespeople, you know, does it work well for other jobs? How are we doing for time? A couple of minutes still?
About a half a minute.
Okay. So we'll move into that in the next segment. So if it works well for other jobs, you know, let's look at some other examples. So we're going to look at teachers and we're going to look at CEOs. and then we're going to move into healthcare to cover the last segment. We are at the break. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Stay with us.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship.
I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak, co-host of The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Please join us in the fight to save the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper and go to this website, www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org, www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I am your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thanks for sticking with us for the final segment. I promise we will make it worth your while. The Doctor's Lounge is sponsored by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation. We promote information. We promote empowerment and choice in healthcare, freedom of choice in healthcare. Please go to our website and make a contribution if you like what you hear on the radio show, or send me a tweet at D4PCFDN. That's capital D, numeral 4, and then all caps, PCFDN. I would love to hear from you about ideas for future shows, what you think about what we're doing here, if you like it, you don't like it, whatever. So we have about 13 minutes left. We're going to talk about how pay-for-performance works in areas outside of healthcare, and then circle back around to healthcare and sort of close the loop and make the case about how pay-for-performance, aside from certain specialized fields like sales, pay-for-performance, it doesn't work anywhere very well. So let's talk about teaching. There was a few references on how pay-for-performance works in the teaching environment, and one huge headline in the Atlanta area that we talked about a few months ago that really addresses how pay-for-performance works in the teaching environment. So let's talk about teachers for a minute. Now, here's a place. You might think that teaching is similar to sales in one way, is that there's some objective measurements that are readily available, right? We have measurements that are readily available. We can see what grades students make, and we can see how they perform on standardized tests. Those would be outcomes measures. Then you can look at what they call process measures, right? Because pay for performance has two things that you can measure. One is process measures, which is what are you doing, and then outcomes measures, which is what are the results, right? So we go back to the example from the last segment, my dad's sales jobs. You know, process measures might be how many sales calls do you make? How many people do you visit? How many people do you take out to lunch and sell things to? You know, what are you doing? What are your processes? And then the results are obvious, which is how much are you selling? What's your revenue look like? Teaching might have the same thing. Say, well, which history books are you buying? How much time are you spending teaching math? You know, what time do you get there in the morning? What time do you go home? How many students do you help after school? Right? Those would all be process criteria. And then we have results criteria, which might be the grades that your students are getting. And then probably most importantly or seemingly objectively would be their scores on standardized tests. It turns out if you look at the research on it, it doesn't work. And it doesn't work for a lot of reasons, some of which have in common with healthcare. One of the biggest ones is that there are too many factors going on in the classroom that are beyond the teacher's control. Right? One is the natural gifts that students bring to the classroom. Right? If you're teaching a classroom that's been selected to be, you know, the best kids in school, they're going to do well if all you do is show up. They might even do well if you don't show up. At the other end of the spectrum are the kids that struggle, right? The kids that are special needs, the kids that have dyslexia or ADD or autism or something like that. They're at the other end of the spectrum. And usually these pay-for-performance things treat one classroom like any other, right? Here, another thing is parental involvement, right? Teachers, I think, can tell you. I'm guessing here a little bit because I've never asked, but I would suspect the teachers will tell you there's a huge spectrum in how much parents are involved. Some parents don't want to be bothered, and other parents are probably involved a little too much, right? The so-called helicopter parents that hover everywhere. But the parent is another variable that's in the equation. So if you're going to put pay for performance on teachers, you're going to put them in a situation where there are too many factors beyond their control. And that's exactly what a lot of this research that I found indicates. The other problem is a problem that we would call white noise. And this seems to happen across all fields, whether it's healthcare or teaching or something else, which is you can take the same teacher, right, who's should be teaching roughly the same from year to year and measure their quality by whatever measure you want, standardized test scores, grades, whatever, and you see huge fluctuations in the measurement of their quality, both up and down. And so there's so much fluctuation that the data are useless. There's too much white noise. You can't isolate any trends when there's that much white noise. And so, you have a situation where there's too many factors outside the control of the teacher, too much white noise that makes the measurements meaningless. And then another big one, and this definitely applies to medicine, which is too much delay in seeing the results. For example, if a teacher knocks him or herself out to teach math to a group of students, you might not see the results until years later when that foundation that teacher gives them in math is a good foundation for them to go on and learn algebra and trigonometry and geometry and things in later years. Maybe this is an elementary school teacher. You don't see the results till high school. Right, we see the same thing in medicine. If I'm an endocrinologist, I'm not. But if I were an endocrinologist and I had a practice full of diabetic patients and I was working hard to make sure they had good foot care and their blood sugar was controlled and their indicators, something called an HbA1c, was all where it needed to be, you might not see a result from that until 20 years later when a far greater proportion of those diabetics don't have kidney failure, don't have neuropathy, and haven't lost toes and legs and feet, because of what you did 20 years ago. So you have this huge delay, and of course, by that time the patient's probably changed insurance 3 or 4 times, and so there's no true incentive to try and, make those parameters work well. And, the other thing, and this may be the biggest single point, and we talked about this months ago when we were talking about the VA back in the summertime and the VA scandal, is that anytime you create a pay-for-performance system and the measurements have problems, right? The measurements are based on things that the doctor has no control over, or we're talking about teachers, that the teacher has no control over, quality of the students, quality of the parents, and you tie a large amount of their pay to what's going to happen based on grades, standardized test scores, you create a huge incentive, an almost irresistible incentive for cheating, for gaming the system. And here in Atlanta, in the Atlanta public schools, that's exactly what happened. We had a huge scandal where City of Atlanta school teachers were changing the scores on students' standardized tests. And this has been in the news recently because the trial is in progress. And during the trial, one of the major defendants, Ms. Hall, has unfortunately died of cancer. But so it's been in the news again recently. But again, you've got this situation where you put people in a pay-for-performance system, you put a significant amount of their income at risk and put them in a situation where they have no control over what happens, right? You have a bunch of seventh-grade students, and you know that as they sit there and fill in those holes with a number two pencil, that your pay, your job security, your livelihood is based on which little holes they fill in with a number two lead pencil. that creates something that is more of a strain than I think anybody should be expected to bear. And I'm not saying that the cheating was okay, but I'm saying that, you know, you put just about anybody in that situation where the pressure is that great. And I wonder, you know, how many people could resist and stay honest over enough years, especially if you see the nice guys finishing last. So that covers teachers. Let's cover CEOs very briefly, right? You know, CEOs of big companies like to do pay for performance. I'm going to go over this very briefly so we can go on to healthcare, but it turns out that, you know, you would think that the more you pay a CEO, the better their performance should be, right? Right? You would assume that. It turns out the relationship is inverse. And if you look at, you know, the top 10% of CEOs in terms of pay, that as a group, their performance is terrible. Right, the value of the company drops 13% over 5 years if your CEO is one of the top paid ones. So top paid CEOs, as a rule, don't do well, probably for two reasons. One is, if you've got that much money, who cares if you get any more? And number two, at that level of pay, the level of arrogance and overconfidence is so high that, you know, I think these people, you know, probably think they rule by divine right. I don't presume to know what's in their head, but this is what's in the research I found. That they have this arrogance and overconfidence when the pay is that high that they can do no wrong. So if there's any data that makes it look like your decisions are bad, well, we'll just ignore that. And if it turns out that, you know, your company doesn't do so well, even if you get fired, I mean, if you earned, you know, $72 million the year before, who really cares? So, you know, at that point, seems like it should be okay. So let's look in the last few minutes we got left, you know, CMS, right? Center for Medicare, Medicaid Services. The federal government has several, programs in place, three main ones and a couple of smaller ones, that are the pay for performance programs. So the first one is a fancy thing called the Inpatient Value-Based Purchasing Program. This is an idea where, I got to give you a little background. Medicare pays hospitals based on these things called DRGs, diagnosis-related groups. So a hospital gets paid a certain amount of money based on the diagnosis the patient has when they walk in the door. So what CMS decided to do in its questionable brilliance is to say, look, we're going to, for all hospitals across the board, we're going to start you off lower. We're going to take away, I don't know what the number was, let's say 5%. We're going to just lower your payments by 5% across the board. And make you earn it back by these quality performance scores. And so you might do well, right? I mean, that's how they sell it. They say, well, look, you might do so well in the quality performance scores, you'll earn your 5% back and then some. The trouble is they engineered it to be a zero-sum game, so anybody who, you know, earns extra money, that money has to be taken away from another hospital that doesn't do so well. And the bottom line is that this was studied. This was studied going all the way back to 2003 in the Premier Hospital program, and they found that that incentive programs for hospitals just don't work. They don't work, and they don't work in other ways too, right? There's another program called the Hospital Readmission Program that penalizes hospitals. Will cut their payments if their 30-day readmission rates exceed a certain. A certain threshold. Problem with that is, again, you're going to game the system. You're going to make hospitals pay for things that are beyond their control. It turns out that, you know, 30-day readmission rates are higher in large inner-city hospitals, in teaching hospitals, in safety net hospitals where uninsured patients go for care. Why? Because that patient demographic doesn't perform as well when they're out of the hospital. And it's not because they're bad people or, you know, whatever. It is what it is. That's what the data show. And so what happens? If you create a pay-for-performance system that a component of that is dependent on patients, then providers will avoid high-risk patients. So if I'm in a pay-for-performance program and somebody sick walks in the door, what am I going to do? Am I going to treat them? No. I'm going to turf them. I'm going to refer them. Why? I don't want that sick patient inside my hospital statistics, inside my pay-for-performance statistics, because I'm going to get penalized for taking the sick patients. Nobody wants to take care of the sick patients. So, you know, in the last 30 seconds, what does quality mean to me? What does it mean to me? It is intangibles. It is intangible stuff. It's things like when a patient walks in the room, I'm going to listen to them. I'm going to see what it is that they have to say. I'm going to read what they wrote. I'm going to listen to them. I'm going to ask them pertinent questions. I'm going to repeat back to them what they said so they know that I know. Tell them what the physical findings are. Tell them what, lots of dialogue, lots of back and forth. And there's no way to measure that. There is no way to measure this ethereal concept of quality. And that is the fundamental problem. That's what Dr. Terry was talking about in his thing. We are out of time, and I got to stop. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.